Most Egyptologists agree that all Egyptians, regardless of social class, were well-fed. And there is even forensic evidence among mummies that many of these people overate, meaning that they have gallstones sometimes, they have arteriosclerosis.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 3, Egypt and the Gift of the Nile. Ancient Egypt's prosperity, impressive court culture, and their isolation from conflict led to a sophisticated food tradition and the emergence of the world's first elite cuisine. In this podcast, we'll study the archaeological evidence of ancient Egyptian food customs, the religious significance of Egyptian foodstuffs and animals, and the specific components of their cuisine. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
The cultivation of early forms of wheat and barley, both for bread and beer, as well as a variety of beans, vegetables, and animal husbandry, formed the agricultural complex that made possible the first civilization on Earth. And this culture is generally referred to as Sumer, and it's a region that encompassed a few dozen cities situated between the Tigris and Euphrates River. And these are Lagash, Umma, Uruk, Ur, all of them are in modern-day Iraq. And these people created complex irrigation systems. They practiced a form of monoculture, that is, growing single crops intensively. And these cities really began to flourish around 4,000 to 3,500 BC. And it's here that the first recorded recipes are found. And actually, they're not really written by Sumerians, but Akkadians. Those are people from the north who invaded and conquered and really adopted the civilization of the Sumerians. So let me describe these. There are three cuneiform tablets written about 1600 BC. The first of them is rather largish. It includes 25 recipes, mostly for meat and soups, but four are actually for vegetable soups. The second has seven recipes, and the third, which is really pretty badly damaged, only has three. And I think most of these recipes are actually quite simple in preparation, but the range of ingredients that they incorporate is actually quite complex. Take, for example, a broth that's made with a piece of meat added to a pot with water and then fat, and salt, flavorings like onion, cumin, coriander, and leeks. And sometimes they would add something like crumbs for thickness or blood. Actually, let me read one for you. This is called Amursanu pigeon broth. And it says, split the pigeon in two. Other meat is also used. Prepare water, add fat, salt to taste, breadcrumbs, onion, samidu, don't know what that is, leek, garlic. Before using, soak these herbs in milk, and it is ready to serve. Now, obviously, the author assumed that all this stuff would be cooked before serving, and he assumes that the person knows how to cook. And there are, in fact, more complicated recipes, too. There's one that involves sheets of dough that have a filling of fowl and onions, and it's sprinkled with mint. And it's kind of like a big pie, if you can imagine it. But keep this recipe in mind, because we will find similar recipes many centuries down the road when we get to the area in the Middle Ages. But enough of Sumer, let's turn to Egypt. And I'm going to do this for several reasons. The real reason is it is the first place to have a fully developed, socially stratified civilization that's outside the Fertile Crescent. That is, the agricultural revolution is actually imported to Egypt. And it's also the first place that we have full, not just documentary evidence, but archaeological evidence of things like agriculture, domestication, cooking, medicine. And there are extensive writings as well as paintings of foodstuffs. That is, I think we can be confident that we can actually talk about the history of food here in Egypt. Not to mention that there is tons of physical evidence provided courtesy of the hundreds of preserved Egyptian mummies, who were actually often even entombed with actual jars of food. So the strange irony is sometimes we know more about the ancient Egyptians and their food than we would even about a person 100 years ago. So there's this revealing story of these group of Egyptologists, and they find this perfectly sealed jar of honey. And they open the thing up, and they smell it, and they figure, okay, let's see if it's still good. They decide to take a taste. And then another guy tastes it, and it turns out to be really fine. And there they are eating these spoonfuls of the honey until one guy notices a little hair on the spoon. And so they dip down further into the bottom of the jar, and they find a perfectly preserved human baby at the bottom. So gruesome, I know. But Egypt was ruled almost continuously by the same people from roughly 3000 BC all the way to 525 BC when the Persians came in, and then the Greeks after them. So it really does have a very long and stable history. I mean, we're talking here 2.5 millennia. You know, perhaps it is the longest continual civilization on Earth. I think the only thing that comes closer beats it would be China. The other thing about Egypt is that it has long stretches of peaceful and very prosperous dynasties. And that's, you know, very unlike the Sumerians, because remember, those cities were constantly fighting among themselves. You remember the Epic of Gilgamesh? And Egypt, really in contrast, is a very big, stable empire with a very well-developed court culture. And all of these people surround the pharaoh, and he's basically the patron for this entire civilization. And this means, as you can guess, that they have very highly developed artistic traditions. And that, of course, includes the culinary arts. There are no actual recipes, unfortunately, from pharaonic times, but many, many medical compounds and things that are, let's say, they come very close to being culinary recipes. And what, in general, we get from the documents is that Egyptians were very fun-loving people. For example, they made beer in enormous quantities, and it's a regular part of their diet. And I'm not talking just here for merriment and weekend pleasure. It provides calories in their diet, and they need beer to survive. I think also the geography of Egypt is very important to this story also. It makes a really nice contrast to Mesopotamia. See, the Tigris and the Euphrates were very unpredictable rivers. And in order to manage them, the Sumerians channeled it and they used it basically to irrigate most of Sumer. But what happened is after centuries and centuries, the soil became increasingly salinized, which made the land in the so-called Fertile Crescent, at least that area, much less fertile over the years. And eventually, that whole civilization collapses or disintegrates, let's say, because of it. And this, you might argue, was the very first man-made ecological disaster in human history. Because if you look at that place now, it's a desert. Now, in contrast, in Egypt, the Nile floods very predictably each year. It goes from upper, which is in the bottom, to lower Egypt, and it flows into the delta, bringing tons of silt and rich soil with it. And that means that Egypt is, and still remains, extremely fertile, at least just along that floodplain. But the other interesting thing is once you get beyond that river and its floodplain, there's desert, and that gives these people a great deal of protection. And again, the contrast to be made is with Sumer. Sumer's on an open plain, and that means that they are constantly subject to invasion from the north, especially. Oh, but all this means for Egypt is that while most ancient civilizations spend much of their energy waging war, either to expand their territory or to defend it from invaders, the Egyptians can spend their time really having fun, building pyramids in the early part of their history, and nice temples and cities. And the interesting thing is, until the later periods, they don't even have a standing army for most of their history. And part of that has to do with this extremely rigid and hierarchical social structure. And picture this, there is not only the pharaoh up at the top, and of course he's an absolute ruler, a semi-divine being descended from the gods, but of course that person has to be fed in style, along with the royal family, with the class of priests, with the bureaucrats. And so what this means, this is the first culture in which we get a distinct elite cuisine. And in fact, not coincidentally, an explicit nutritional theory. I think both of these things often go hand in hand. You know, they're even though they're really opposed, imagine that on the one hand, you have cooks telling you, here's what you'd really like to eat and serving up fine meals. And then you have the physicians on the other hand saying, here's what you really ought to be eating. And here's the nutritional theory that explains these strictures. So they really do go together. The other feature about Egypt is they had these extensive trade networks. And these extend not just to the south, to Nubia, and in fact, to the rest of Africa, but they head toward Asia. They have trade with various Semitic peoples, and in fact, across the Mediterranean. They trade with the Greek inhabitants of Crete, and in fact, the Cretans bring copper and olive oil. But I think if I had to make a statement about this, I think none of the things that the Egyptians imported were really necessities. For the most part, Egypt is self-sufficient. The things that they're importing are luxury items. And of course, it's primarily the wealthy who consume them, but most of the food they need, they produce right there. And I think the basic distinction to be made between the poor and the wealthy is pretty much the same as in most civilizations right down to the present. The wealthy eat more meat, which of course was expensive, costly to raise, but they also eat a wide range of waterfowl. They're the ones who are consuming imported luxuries like spices and incense and fruits and wine and large fish. And the Egyptians were very fond of those. Oddly enough, the priests weren't allowed to eat certain species. When Osiris was murdered, he was cut up and his genitals were thrown into the water and the fish ate them. And remember, he's a god of fertility. So I guess those become forbidden for priests as a result of that. But in any case, the rich diet is very different from the poor. The poor eat more grains and vegetables. They eat onions and cabbages, a lot of cucumbers. And of course, they drink a lot of beer. And instead of the larger birds, and fish, they eat smaller ones, smaller game birds or smaller fish on occasion. But most Egyptologists agree that all Egyptians, regardless of social class, were well-fed. And except for those occasions when there were plagues, things like locusts and murrain, that's a cattle disease that kills sheep too, and hail, remember those from the Bible? Egypt was actually fertile enough to supply an extremely consistent and predictable crop. And the only direct evidence of malnutrition actually comes from frequent reference to intestinal worms that they would get. And things like schistosomiasis, which comes from parasites that happen when you walk in water with bare feet. The worms actually burrow up into your feet, go into your bloodstream, and then are excreted through your urine and then can infect other people. And that would cause malnutrition. But otherwise, there's little evidence of nutritional deficiencies. And in fact, even the kinds that will affect other cultures like rickets and scurvy that we see in the 19th century, or even goiter, sometimes pellagra that affects modern Egyptians, that is just not there in ancient Egypt. And there is even forensic evidence among mummies that many of these people overate, meaning that they have gallstones sometimes. They have arteriosclerosis, and really interestingly, especially among priests, there's evidence of alcoholism. They look at the livers and they're cirrhotic, and apparently priests were known for being heavy drinkers. Egyptians, and I think this does relate to food, loved animals too. You know, they kept them as pets. They mummified their cats. They worshiped them as gods. Of course, they used symbols of animals in their writing system and the hieroglyphics. But they also loved to eat animals, and animals could either be sacrificed to the gods. It's a little confusing because some animals would be sacrificed to the god as sacred, but other times it meant a sacred animal meant that they had to protect it, like cats to Sekhmet. So it's not entirely clear which one it is, but in any case, they really, really love their animals. But the sacrifice itself is also a fascinating thing. In some cultures, it is just a way to feed the god. And then you obtain favor, you ask the god, it's supplication, right? You're asking the god for a certain favor, and you're saying, I will feed you with this sacrifice. And sometimes it's actually an offering made to the dead or ancestors, so they'll have something to eat on the journey into the afterlife. But what all that means is that in Egypt, we have actual foods buried along with mummies in tombs. I mean, I'm talking about whole dishes laid out exactly as they would have been, you know, to people eating at the time. sometimes, if that's not there, there'll actually be depictions on tomb walls so people can be sort of spiritually fed. And the Egyptians, it is interesting, they don't seem to have many rigid food prohibitions that are sort of set down in these complex law codes like you'd find among the Hebrews or the Hindus. But for some people, some kinds of people, they might have a taboo. For example, the priests or members of a specific cult to a particular deity might not be allowed to eat a certain food. But the Egyptians don't seem to have had any that are universal or ones that don't change over time. There's evidence, oddly, that at sometimes pork was prohibited, but it's clear at other times it's eaten. So even though there are no explicit food laws, there are certainly many religiously influenced ideas about what can be eaten or what cannot be eaten by certain kinds of people. So let's talk about what they did eat.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from history, science, Tai Chi, anthropology, Spanish, guitar, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
First and foremost, like all these ancient civilizations, grain is at the top, and Egypt was very fertile. Every visitor to Egypt in classical times, especially Herodotus, mentions how fertile Egypt is and how much grain they have. So there's real abundance here. The grain, for the most part, is actually emmer. So it's a primitive ancestor of modern wheat. And we know that the state actually stored massive amounts of grain to prevent famine in the case of, a crop failure or a lean year. Do you remember the story of Joseph, where there's 7 years of bounty that he dreams will be followed by 7 years of famine? And so they just save up the grain, and that way they don't starve. But the Egyptians really did have these huge earthenware jars that would have made excellent storage vessels, right? They keep out the moisture. They prevent pests from going in. So storage is a state policy. But they did often import grain too, quite often from Syria. Or if they conquered a region later in the newer kingdoms, they would have collected it as tribute from a subject state. And in fact, Egypt did enter into an empire building stage during the New Kingdom. That's after about 1500 BC. And the state, interestingly, would take all this grain and they would distribute it as a kind of welfare system that would be administered by the priests. So they would sort of offer a little bit to the gods, and then they would redistribute this as a kind of public benefit. There is also evidence that the Egyptians could use grain as taxation. The farmers might have to pay a proportion of their crop to a local administrator, and then he could use it either for his own household purposes, or maybe he'd send it on to the pharaoh, or maybe he could even sell it for profit. So grain, let me emphasize, takes on so much importance really because it can be stored. And because the Egyptians, oddly, they don't have money. I know this sounds odd, but until very late in their history, they don't have money. So grain becomes the sort of standard unit of exchange. Barley also figures prominently in Egyptian myths about resurrection. I don't know why barley and not the other grains, but barley, remember, the plant dies and the seed goes dormant and then it sprouts up into a new plant. So it was kind of a symbol for the afterlife. And mummies would often be buried with these necklaces made out of barley. Or even more interestingly, they'd take a board in the shape of Osiris, who's the god of the underworld, and they'd cover this thing with mud, and then they'd plant it with barley seeds and then bury it with the dead, and later on it would sprout, and presumably it would feed the dead in the afterlife, which I find fascinating. Egyptian bread is also equally fascinating. We know the Egyptians ate a whole range of different kinds of bread. These could be made from barley for the lower classes, emmer wheat that's more finely ground and bolted, that's a sifting process through cloths, was for the upper classes. And we also know that they leavened their bread with yeast. And actually, many years ago at a conference, I met this man named Ed Wood, who claimed to have been around the ancient temple in ancient pyramids in Giza, and he says he scraped yeast cells from the walls of an ancient Egyptian bakery in the area, from dating from about 2575 BC. And I think he actually sold it online. You might still even be able to find it. Now, that sounds a little bizarre to me, because in fact, yeast changes from week to week. If you move yeast, it picks up different bacteria and changes dramatically. So I'm not entirely certain that you could save yeast that long. But in any case, the Egyptians did have dozens of different kinds of raised bread. Some of these they would bake in an oven, some they would fry, some were cooked in a flat pan, kind of like a pita. But my favorite is this kind of bread that would be baked in a cylindrical clay oven, kind of like a tandoor. So you'd take the bread and you'd slap it on the inside wall, and then you could stuff it with dates or sweetened with honey or something like that, or you could twist it into various shapes. They're really very, very interesting. But the one that is sort of the iconic and completely unique form of Egyptian bread are these cone-shaped loaves. And what they would do is bake it in a kind of flower pot-shaped clay vessel. And they use these as offerings. You find them in tombs as food for the afterlife. And workers would be buried with these. Often they were paid in bread. It's used as a sacrifice in temples. So bread really is this kind of staple food for everyone. We also know that the Egyptians ground their wheat on what's called a saddle kern. So if you can imagine this big curved stone on which you place a grain, and then you rock back and forth this large stone cylinder. It's a lot of work to do the grinding. The Romans, by contrast, used a rotary kern, which has two separate stones that you turn around. And eventually, of course, they make these huge stone mills that are pushed by donkeys or oxen. But the Egyptians used these smaller saddle kerns. And the result is that they got a lot of grit in their bread. And their teeth are almost always badly worn. They have cavities all over the place. That's partly from the starch sticking to their teeth and causing cavities. But it's also the grit of grinding down bread. The Egyptians also ate a lot of wild game, and in fact, for the wealthy, hunting was one of the most favorite pastimes, and there's still a lot of game in the area. You know, there's ibex, gazelle, antelopes, and that's sort of what they do on a weekend is go out hunting. But the Egyptians, above all, loved beef. They had a large-scale cattle industry, especially in the northern part of the country, where there are broader, flatter plains. The South is a little different. I mean, the South is bounded by deserts and has these sort of steep cliffs, and it's much better for goat, but the cattle predominate in the North, and you'd recognize them. They're these long-horned breed. If you've ever seen the goddess Hathor, you know Hathor? She's the nourishing mother goddess figure of the sky and goddess of moisture. I'm not sure why, but Hathor and Apis, the sacred bull, they have these big long horns. The Egyptians also made oxen out of their cattle, and that's basically done just by castrating them. And the logic is that they grow much bigger, much more docile, and then you can use it as a draft animal or use it for plowing or whatever. It's the smaller steers that they usually would butcher for meat, though. There are numerous illustrations from ancient Egypt of butcher shops showing cut up pieces of meat. So we even know how, you know, their butchering techniques from the cuts. What we don't know is how they cooked it, though. There are illustrations of boiling foods and illustrations of roasting fowl, but you really don't see meat roasting. So the assumption is probably that they boiled it. They also kept dairy cows, and there are frequent depictions of milkmaids. In fact, my favorite is this one with a mother cow tied up. She's hobbled, and the little baby cow is there next to her, and she's crying because they're taking her milk away. It's really sad. But anyway, the priests also kept these sacred bulls. And if you remember, it's why the Israelites made a golden calf to worship in the desert. They were just following their customs back in Egypt. But the sacred bull for the priests had special marks to denote that they were reincarnations of the god Apis. And people would come to visit the bull in his shrine. This is at the capital city of Memphis. And they would make a kind of offering to the bull. And the bull delivered prophecies. Now, I don't know how the bull speaks, but I guess it's through the priests. They get some prophecy. And in fact, when the bull died, the priests would mourn. They'd stop shaving. And eventually, they would mummify it and look for a successor. So we have a lot of these huge mummified bulls of Apis. The Egyptians also used, let's call them beef byproducts. I don't know what else to say. They're in medicines. So they would use ox grease for things like ointments and salves. They would use extracts of the internal organs to cure ailments. Milk goes into all sorts of medicines. And in fact, it's interesting. There are a lot of medical recipes survive in the Ebers papyrus and the Hearst papyrus that's in Berkeley. So we know really a lot about what they used in their medicines. As for pork, Egyptians, they definitely kept pigs in their earlier period, but like the Hebrews, they seem to have avoided it later. And there's no written evidence of a taboo, but there interestingly are practically no remains or depictions of pigs. And in fact, they're forbidden to be used in sacrifices. So I'll come back to the reasons for possible pork avoidance next time. But there is evidence that they were eaten in some periods. So, you know, maybe when the Israelites were there, and maybe that's one reason they were forbidden when Moses, you know, wrote down these dietary restrictions. Maybe he was trying to set the Hebrews apart from other people. But I'll come to that down the road. Sheep and goats were also domesticated. They're introduced from Asia along with the ibex, which is a kind of Nubian mountain goat, which is African. The sheep they keep mostly for wool, although priests aren't allowed to wear it for some reason. And wealthy people also seem to have avoided it. It was, I guess mutton was seen as a kind of common food. Among the fowl that I mentioned, the Egyptians loved geese, ducks, cranes, pigeons, quail. Of course, those are all hieroglyphic symbols too, and they're all worshipped. You know, think of all the bird-headed gods like Horus, who has a falcon head. But they don't eat those, they don't eat falcons, but they use them to catch other birds as a kind of sport. But they also hunt bigger animals, bigger birds with bow and arrow. Waterfowl used for food were usually wild, and they would catch them in big nets. They would keep ducks and geese and fatten them in pens. So they're not really technically domesticated, but they certainly live with the people. And fowl were also used as temple offerings. Ramses III, in his 31st year of his reign, offered 326,000 birds in sacrifice. And you often find cooked geese included in funerary offerings buried with the deceased. Eventually, they used little stone ones, but originally it's food. There's also archaeological find of a pigeon stew from a tomb at Saqqara. I wish they would figure out what's in it, do some chemical analysis. The ibis is sacred and associated with Thoth, and he's forbidden as food. And in fact, they're extinct now in Egypt. Falcons and vultures and other birds that are associated with specific gods are forbidden. Domestic chickens are really not there until very late, and they're probably not used until Ptolemaic or Roman times. But let's turn to fish. Fish, the Egyptians love them. They fished for sport with spears, with hook and line, or nets, or sometimes weirs, kind of traps to catch the fish. And it's very hard to precisely identify the species they ate from the Egyptian words or even from the paintings. And there aren't many remains as with other animals. But without going into the species, they did have elaborate ways of preparing and preserving fish. Obviously, they're very perishable. And there are depictions of dried and salted fish being carried in baskets or being stacked for sale. And there's one example of a preserved remains of a whole salted fish. They also ate salted fish roe from mullet. That's called botarga. And in fact, in Italian today, that's what it's called, but it's batarech. In Egypt, and that word actually may come from a Coptic word, meaning that it's descended directly from the original Egyptian language. They sometimes ate crocodiles, but that's a sacred thing. Wine, like wheat and grapes, were introduced to Egypt, and vineyards were only owned by the wealthiest of people, and there's frequently harvesting scenes, or they're painted on tombs. But the Egyptians really became connoisseurs of wine. Their wine jars buried in King Tut's tomb, for example, with the estate and winemaker and year of vintage on it. So that's pretty good evidence that there's a luxury trade in wine, and they buried people with really good wine and alabaster golden cups and things like that. There are also wine festivals to Osiris, who is later associated with Dionysus. So in brief, it may be something similar to that whole intoxication ritual where people are brought into the ecstatic state, like we'll see in Greece. But we do know that wine libations were poured on sacrificial victims before offering them. Lettuce, the milky sap kind of older varieties, for some reason, you know, when you break lettuce open, some older varieties have this kind of milk comes out. That, to the Egyptians, suggested semen. So they used it as a fertility offering to the gods. They also had celery and cabbage and gourds and cucumbers, a whole slew of beans, fava beans, black-eyed peas, chickpeas, lentils, vetches, and the priests are supposed to avoid them. It may have something to do with metempsychosis or reincarnation. And in fact, Pythagoras may have gotten the idea from them, but we'll come back to them. But I should mention the classic breakfast in Egypt is ful medames, and it's a kind of a fava bean stew. There's also papyrus, and I should mention it here because it's obviously writing material, but it's also the young shoots that can be peeled and steamed. There's also sedge, a kind of little starchy tuber, and lotus, which I'm sure you've seen in dried flower arrangements, but that's eaten all the time. I should mention also spices, cumin, anise, coriander, fenugreek, mustard. All of those are used in cuisine. They're used in medicine. They're also used in mummification. Garlic and onions are also very important, and apparently they fed these to slaves who built the great Middle Kingdom tombs. They cultivated figs, date palms, apples, plums, carob, pomegranates, and olive oil was for the first time imported, but later on they start growing it in dynastic Egypt. They also have sesame oil and sesame seed paste, a kind of forerunner of tahini, but that's probably the most dominant cooking oil until about the 3rd century BC, and of course it comes from Africa. Mostly they used animal fats for cooking. Sometimes nuts or radish or lettuce seeds can be pressed into oil, but there's really not much evidence of frying food, maybe a couple of breads, but they didn't have things like cheese and butter and milk. One thing I would like to mention is salt. Very important, obviously, for preserving food, but also the form of natron, which is a kind of soda ash that's very important because not only do we get this chemical symbol for sodium, Na, from them, but also they use it in mummifying. So Egypt's direct influence on us has been limited by the fact that the Persians conquer Egypt, then Alexander the Great. But in the ancient world, in many respects, inherited Egypt's agricultural, medical, and culinary knowledge, and of course their love of good food. And as we'll see, Alexandria remains a cultural entrepôt in the ancient world, and a trading hub for exotic goods well into modern times. But the broader theme I want to leave you with is that a civilization blessed with great fertility and natural boundaries, combined with court patronage from the top, it will definitely have a complex court cuisine and one that will last for millennia. And above all is the role of patronage. And it's important to remember that what happens when wealth is concentrated in the hands of a single powerful ruler, the arts flourish, including cuisine. So next time, we will look at a very different civilization, no less obsessed with food, although not in quite the same way. We'll turn next to the ancient Hebrews and the kosher laws that they developed.
Thanks for listening to episode 3 of Food, a Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from history, science, fitness, philosophy, mathematics, literature, travel, cooking, photography, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.